begin there, I suppose. If we look where we began the weekend, we were looking at the serpent Mehen, who is the serpent who is our guide, our companion, our helper in this whole process of the Book of Gates. And the characteristic form of Mehen is this sort of image of this spiraling serpent that is continually moving forward while recapitulating all the previous kind of experiences. Now that is opposed in a way to the chaotic serpent of Apep, or Apophis, as the Greeks called it, which is this energy that is chaotic and has no direction at all, but whose intent is just to stop the creative process of the universe. So the Apep is a primary resistance, basically, we could say. The whole kind of function of Apophis or Apep is just to stop everything. It's the entropic principle that will just stop the whole nature of the universe, and that is opposed by this quality that the Egyptians called Ra or Re, which is the creative life of the universe that is constantly creating and recreating. And in this process, Mehen is the serpent who assists, who protects Ra, who enables Ra, and who enables us to work with these processes, not in a linear way, but in a spiral way, so that we keep on revisiting places. And this is the key thing in the Book of Gates, where Ra keeps entering an hour and leaving an hour, entering an hour, leaving an hour, working with whatever presents itself in that hour, and then passing on until meeting it the next time round. But the overall sense, though, is of something that is evolving forward, moving gradually, little by little, forward. And in our personal processes, it's the movement between beginning a path and becoming one who is a finished one or a completing one. There never is a completing point, so it's more like a completing process or a finishing process, where you keep on going through this process at deeper and deeper levels. But that's why, in a sense, you have this kind of image of the with the seven jackal posts of a finished one end, a golden one the other end, and you can go at it either way. And that it's like the golden one, the finished ones, are bracketing that whole process, saying like this whole process is about this, and you can pick it up from this end, you can pick it up from that end, you can look at it in the middle, bits of it will keep on interacting, but the key thing is to keep moving, is to keep following the process. So it's to trust that subtle movement that arises when you get present. Now, the other thing we've looked at this weekend, really, and has come into the weekend quite a lot, is the figure of Paddy Aminope. And he is an interesting figure because he represents this and holds out this capacity to renew and to recreate. Now, literally, he does this in the Kushite period, where Egypt, prior to the Kushites taking over, Egypt had fallen into a lot of chaos and had lost touch with a lot of its older traditions. So there is a literal recreation that we find in the in the tomb of Paddy Aminope, for example, where he brings together all the old kind of traditions of Egypt and records them in stone. I just want to share, as I found another image which I don't think I've shown you before. You're getting this image. Hopefully that's coming through. Okay, do you see the picture of there's a two pictures, really. One is a sort of. You can see where my cursor is on the left here. Yeah? There's a series of steps leading up to the figure of Osiris. You see that? This is the, if you remember, the image of the tomb of Osiris, where the first one is the straightforward Kushite tomb that leads to the image of Osiris. Well, that is this image. So here you can see the remnants of the false stool there, and there's a further move there. So the perspective, if you were further back, how this looks is you look like you're receding into infinity and ascending this stairway. And here we have it's quite damaged, but you can just about see the mummified Osiris. You can just see the white crown of Lower Egypt there. Upper Egypt, rather, and then the mummiform figure of Osiris. So that's the image that you find right at the end of the first bit of his tomb, which is the Osiris tomb. The one on the right is another illustration of the corridor that's around the shrine of Osiris. And what you're getting a nice look at as well is the bulbs that are on. These are the lights that are just on the floor. They're like sort of random bulbs and wires that light it up because it hasn't got proper lighting, really. So
it's a double step in that goes up and down. So it's people queuing up to get up and then coming down. Is that the idea? The steps?
These steps here?
Yeah.
No, they're just that. It's just this is the stairway, so they're not queuing up and going down again.
It seems to be a double stairway. That's all. The right hand side is destroyed.
No, it's not really intended to be that. It actually is a simple stairway. It's just the way it looks on the thing. It actually is a straightforward stairway leading to the encounter with Osiris. Because the idea is you're going in to the presence of Osiris. You're going into that world. You're actually moving outside the world we know, really. So it's pretty much a sort of straightforward thing in a way.
And Ian, that's the end of that first corridor going down into the crypt, is that right? Before it
Yes, that's right. Before you then turn to the right to where you go into then the sort of replica of the New Kingdom tomb and the Middle Kingdom and the pyramid text. So that's just the first, that's the end. That's that first bit where you come from the sun court into the covered courts. This is the bit where it ends, basically, really, just there. So it's just, I didn't realise I had that image. I just thought it might be useful for you to see it. So there we are. Now, the other important thing about Paddy Amenhotep is because we're looking at this place of renewal. So here's somebody who literally renews something in the Kushite period. But also here's this kind of remarkable sort of prescient figure who looks forward into human history and somehow foresees a time where all this will be ruined. And that's why we get this inscription about you who wander in the necropolis for instruction and pleasure. Read the inscriptions, make offering to the great God so that which has been destroyed may be renewed. So in a way, that's the one of the key principles behind the Book of Gates, that which has been destroyed, that which is needful to bring about regeneration, will renew itself. And that has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, this is why the Book of Gates starts to be inscribed in tombs at the beginning of the New Kingdom, and the first of all in the tomb of Horemheb, and then in the tomb of Seti I. It was because we're right after the Akhenaten revolution, which pretty much destroys much of Egypt's traditions. So this book, among others, like the Book of the Amduat, is recorded because these things, because they are worried that these things will be lost. And of course, the reason it isn't lost principally is down to the tomb of Seti I. Were not for the tomb of Seti I, we would not have the entire Book of Gates. It's a combat. I mean, we'd have been able to start piecing lots of it together from the various of the tombs: Ramses III, Ramses VI, and Horemheb's tomb. But the thing that's enabled us to really have a really good view of it is the extraordinary alabaster sarcophagus of Seti I. And the fact that it is an alabaster, you know, this is the only alabaster sarcophagus found in the Valley of the Kings. Normally they're granite. And the use of alabaster is because this is the idea of the embodiment of light, because light shines through alabaster, and it's a similar idea to becoming a golden one, so that the flesh shines. So the idea is that the Pharaoh who, for the Pharaoh who sits in the alabaster coffin, his light shines out through the coffin into the world. Because the idea of all these tombs is not that they is actually that they are machines of resurrection through which the blessing and the light of the Pharaoh, or the light of the being inside, shines out into the world. And the in the tomb of Seti, for example, the beginning of the book starts at the deepest part of the tomb and then starts to move outwards. So the idea is that the Pharaoh who sits in the dark, in the deep place, is the fusion of Osiris and Ra, and who each day rises with Ra and participates in the work of keeping the world systems turning. Aye, please, yeah, surely.
The offering.
Yeah.
I'm sometimes getting a little bit muddled in my mind. The offering is awareness. It is attention, awareness.
Yeah.
Some kind of devotion even.
Yeah, very much.
Thinking about the spectrum between offering the flowers and gifts and sacrifice.
Yeah. So the whole idea of offering itself, right, is the idea of giving something. It's giving the fruits of the earth. It's offering. It's an act of gratitude. An offering is an act of gratitude fundamentally, and so that's where you give things that are precious in order to uplift whatever it is that you're giving to. But the deepest offering is this thing called the Mat offering, which is the offering of your balanced awareness, the offering of your attention, the offering of your sense of wishing Mat, wishing balance, wishing goodness into the world. So that's the deepest form of offering, really. So that's where, when the Pharaoh offers Mat to the god, he's offering the most precious thing that can be offered. And so from this way of understanding it, the most precious thing that we can give is our balanced attention, is our compassionate balanced attention. So that's a very important kind of idea here, really. And in a way, that's the as we move further into this process of ascent, which we're now doing. This is part of what we're looking at, is this process of what emerges. What do we bring back from this process of descent, this process of working with the other world? And one of the important things is this quality of balance, this sense of being able to give attention and to create and to alchemize our environment. This is what is called, right towards the end of the post, being the finished one is like a brewer who alchemizes the world around them. And because it, in a way, this sense of presence, and in a sense, if you like, the sequence ends with being a brewer and then holding fast in the midst of. So it is like you put a marker down, and you here I am. I am this person who radiates Mat. This is the offering I make to the world. And in a way, this is like saying, I am the alchemist. I am the person who just through the nature of my being, by just being and by being aware, I bring this quality of Mat into the world. This is what we see happening in Shakespeare's play, The Tempest, which is his great magician play. We have this magician figure of Prospero, who is trying to put something right. There's been a betrayal, there's been something wrong, and he uses his magic to manipulate the environment, to manipulate the people who end up on his island in order to bring something new into being. And there's a great part right at the end of the Tempest where he drowns his book, he breaks his staff, and he abjures the rough magic. And this is the, and what he abjures there is the magic of manipulation, the magic that controls, that he goes into the deep, he sends his book into the deep sea, he breaks the manipulative will, and he takes up the deeper magic. And in the deeper magic, what he does is he contemplates the marriage of his daughter with the son of his old enemy. So he contemplates the union of opposites, and he contemplates death. So the alchemist in the end is the person who bridges opposites, who is continually working with the process of death and resurrection. And in a way, this is the process that is illustrated in the jackal posts, and it is, of course, the process that is more deeply looked at through the whole journey of the Book of Gates. Thinking of the alchemical process, we're not going to be looking at those in detail, really. But if you're interested in a very good book that just goes through the seven alchemical processes. There's a book by a woman called Catherine McCoon called On Becoming an Alchemist.
Is that K or C?
C.
C.
Catherine with a C.
Can you just spell the surname here?
Yes. MACCOUN.
McCoon.
Catherine, MACCOUN. And the book is called On Becoming an Alchemist. It's a description, really, of her. But it's a very, very chattily written book. It's really, it's not at all heavy, but it actually really describes something about the process of the seven alchemical processes. It won't, and like I say, don't try and match them up in detail with the seven jackal posts. They're not quite the same thing, and there are a lot of correspondences between the alchemical processes and the processes that we've been looking at this weekend.
Could you see the alchemy more as the process of working with the issues of the post?
No,
it's almost like seven levels of working through
them. No. The post is its own alchemical process. Right. So processes. So as you engage with the jackal post, there are processes that are set up. There are a whole number of processes that get set up. It's the encounter with the jackal posts that is the key thing somewhere. And the way to look at it is to visit the posts, to contemplate the phrases that are in the book. So to contemplate, if we look at the adversaries of Ray and the idea of holding fast, the adversaries of a finished one and being a brewer, adversaries of a developing one being empty of infiltration or penetration, adversaries of an empty one, respectfulness, adversaries of overflowing being straight, adversaries of seat of the eye, wealthy one, threshing by foot, adversaries of a distant one or Horus, honor of zeal. So you just take those phrases and you visualize the images. Go through the meditation again as I've done it. What you can do is just, if you want to go into it more deeply, is just visit one of the staffs. Visit one of the places. Contemplate that. See what comes up for you.
May I ask you something?
Yep.
On the back of that is that when you were describing this earlier today, I got a sense of it. Some of them seem to kind of meet some of the Sephiroth as well.
Yeah, there's certainly parallels with the Tree of Life and the processes that are there, definitely. But again, yeah,
my thought was just to kind of, well, just see what images come and don't get too chunky about it.
I think that's actually kind of quite important, really, right? So don't get too. I mean, if natural correspondences emerge, that's fine. That's great. So you encounter one staff, it reminds you of a particular sephirot or a particular alchemical process. That's absolutely fine. That adds to the arising understanding. If we then try and get a bit too detailed about mapping it up, actually it just goes into a sort of a freeze and things get a bit overcomplicated. Because it is its own process in a way. And at the time when they were working this, they would not have known about things like the alchemical processes or the sephirot. They would be just working with these images on their own, in their own way.
Do you think the understanding of the sephirot might have been helped by some of the ancient Egyptian?
Well, there's a whole big discussion only in some ways. Yes, I mean, I think that the background, ancient Egypt and the traditions of ancient Egypt are much older than all these Kabbalistic traditions, and certainly will have contributed to the formation of those traditions. But we have to remember that the Tree of Life, as we know it, appears somewhere around the 12th century, 13th century, something like that, in Europe. And so to try and map a 13th century system in detail on something many thousand years older, if you try to do it in detail, it will not work. If you notice natural correspondences, which I think is the sort of thing that does happen because you know one thing and you're contemplating another, well, that's fine. It just adds to your understanding. But to try and do it in too detailed a way is often a mistake that people make when they're trying to map one system over another. The more important understanding really is, where do these images take you to? And so if linking a particular sephirot to a particular experience takes you somewhere deeper, great, then it works. If on the other hand it takes you into a more cognitive place, well, it's taking you away from the actual experience. So that's always a thing to be a bit careful of.
Ian, I'm very confused now about why I know that alchemy comes, alchem, from Egypt, and I don't see how it's fitting in with our work at all, really. If it's not, I don't see. I mean, have they been painted on some kind of, you know, coffin text? I don't know. What is the relevance of them if we can't use them at the moment? Will we be using them in the future? With the Book of Gates,
I suppose the reason I'm mentioning them is just to give a sort of illustration of this kind of process of the seven Geb posts. We can't have that discussion now in detail. I mean, there is a kind of detailed discussion we could have, Jessica, but I can't do that. It would take me a long time and a lot of other material that I'd have to ask you to all assimilate, and it would take us several years of work to do that. The reason I'm mentioning the alchemical processes is because they have another illustration of a process of transformation. I've mentioned the Catherine McCune book, which is quite a light book, but gives a flavour of the transformational process. It gives a way of looking at a comparative process of looking at sevenfold process of transformation. Not expecting anybody to do, you don't have to buy the book or get into that if it's not useful to you. But it's the key thing, of course, is to really pay attention to the images and the processes that we're looking at. So the images, the ideas. So if the whole idea of alchemy then just confuses, don't look at it. Just stay with the actual kind of material. I guess what I am saying is, and what I do know is, this is some of this material is the precursor to what later then emerges as alchemy. And there's a whole lot I could say about that, but that would take us into a whole other massive topic area, really, which we certainly don't have time for today. But it isn't just random. I mean, there is a whole way that this particular tradition directly contributes to the development of alchemy. If you want to look more concretely at that, if you look up Theodor Abt, who the Jungian in Zurich, he has a whole website and a whole lot of publications that published some of the very early Arabic works on alchemy, which are relevant to this.
Personally, I'm finding just dealing with this is quite challenging enough. Yes. I don't want to start any alchemical hairs at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting hearing that there are correspondences, and that's enough for me. There's enough going on in this book.
Indeed.
Could be accused of
carrying on in us is the alchemical process, isn't it? All
yeah.
the time.
No, that's right. So by engaging with the exercises that we're doing, both the Kabbalistic exercises that work with the middle pillar and the Kabbalistic cross, and by then engaging with the images and ideas of this book, there is an alchemical process, a process of transformation that's getting set up and is continuing to move through us, really. Anything else before we just stop? Let's just see.
I suppose you're recommending that we do this last part at home too.
Yes, of course. So as usual, you know, the whole thing about the work in between sessions is to really reflect upon the material that we've looked at this weekend. Right, to read over the material of the hour, to go back to the meditations which are recorded, and just find your, you know, in your own way, find what's right for you as a way of integrating and deepening into this. In particular, I think this was the other thing to remember. Not, we've concentrated on the jackal post today, but also we looked at the other material of the hour, which is this whole process of the process of gathering the grain, threshing the grain, reaping, and which we find in the alignment with Ma'at that we find in the upper and lower registers of the sixth hour. So also you can just go back to that and reflect on that as well, really. And then, as always, just find your...
We've got 6 weeks, I think, before we meet again.
Something like that. I can't...
I mean, much longer this time than it has to be.
Let me have a look.
We had 3 weeks this time.
This time we've had 3 weeks, because this was quite a concentrated thing. So let's just see when we're meeting up in October. It is... 24th, 25th, that's right, yes. Where are we now? We're on the... So, yeah. Yes, it is about that. It's about five or six weeks. So there's something... So... In a way, there's something about just take the time. We've covered, there's a lot of material in this particular hour. So just take the time to explore it little by little. And, we'll just do that, really.
Well, Ian, thank you so much. I mean, I don't know, it must be exhausting for you doing this for us.
I enjoy it, Jessica. It's good. It's a good group to work with. It's enjoyable material. I'm glad that Zoom is working as well as it is. Actually, yeah. It's working. I'm surprised at how well this has worked. In fact, I didn't. You know, as you all know, I was very sceptical about it at first. So this has been a good discovery. So you can use this kind of material across the internet like this, and it can work. So that's very good.
I think a situation where a teacher can mute the students is not a good idea.
I could have so done with this in Israel so many times, I have to tell you. The idea of being able to mute Israelis, my God, wouldn't that be wonderful? That chance would have been a fine thing. Okay, guys, so that's it. So look after yourselves.